From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. China is accused of locking up as many as a million Uyghur Muslims without trial across its western region, Xinjiang. The government denies the claim, saying people willingly attend special vocational schools to combat terrorism and religious extremism. But as John Sudworth has found out, important new evidence of the reality. A vast and rapid growing network of detention centers where the people held inside are humiliated and abused. Using detailed satellite analysis and reporting from a part of the country where journalists are routinely detained and harassed, he offers his in-depth report on China's hidden camps.
With reports of hundreds of thousands of missing Muslims, this is the story of the evidence we've found despite the attempts to stop us.
Why can't we ask them questions?
Join me, John Sudworth, here on BBC World Service as I search for China's hidden camps. Xinjiang, China's vast far western region, is a place of towering mountain ranges and windswept rolling sand dunes. It's a place of stark beauty and of fear. Checkpoints control the desert highways, and the oasis towns and cities bristle with security. Armored trucks, flanked by police cars, patrol constantly. These public displays of strength are designed, the authorities say, to face down the threat of terrorism. And there's something else here too, something they don't want the world to see.
So that black one without the number plate is definitely it.
There's a silver one.
So it's 8:30 in the morning now, and we've just arrived in the city of Yining. And straight away, as we left the train station, we've got one, two, and another one back there. Three cars following us.
Despite the constant monitoring and following, eventually we find what we're looking for.
Wow.
Evidence of the network of camps in which China is reported to be detaining hundreds of thousands of Muslims.
So this is a building now surrounded by a completely unbroken metal fence, maybe 20 foot high, covered in barbed wire and security cameras. It looks like a fortress.
Behind the blue steel fence is a former school, but it is now what China calls a re-education centre, although it looks more like a prison.
People waiting inside that hut.
A little visitor's reception area.
Any attempt to get out of our car and record on the street is quickly interrupted.
So this is as close as we're being allowed to get to one of these centres. Well, in fact, it seems we're not being allowed to get this close to it at all.
So, for our investigation, we're turning to images that China can't so easily block. Satellite photos. Using publicly available global mapping software, a surprising amount of detail can be revealed. Last year, the school behind the blue fence had a football pitch. The unmistakable green rectangle can be seen on a satellite image taken in September. But fast forward to an image taken in April of this year, and the pitch has been covered with long buildings, what look like accommodation blocks. Zoom in closer, and watchtowers are also now clearly visible. On a corner, just outside the camp fence, we stop to speak to a family.
Hey, how? What are you guys doing here?
Some officials try to stop us recording. But another intervenes. Let them speak, she says.
Are you visiting someone in the training centre?
The young boy, probably around 10 years old, answers. My dad, he says.
The dad's in
there.
Why can't we ask them questions?
The hands cover our lenses and we are abruptly made to stop recording. Xinjiang's main Muslim minority are known as the Uyghurs. Their distinct identity has long set them apart in China. Fair skin, fair hair, and blue or green eyes are common. Their language has Turkic roots, and their ancient Silk Road cities have long tied them to peoples and lands to the west as much as to the east. All of these factors, along with a history of simmering separatism, has made the Uyghurs a focus of suspicion by the Chinese authorities and, in recent years, a target of an intensifying security crackdown. It is to Turkey, with its connections of language and faith, that many have fled. In a cityscape that echoes to the sound of the call to prayer on the banks of Istanbul's River Bosphorus, I meet Abdusalam Mehmet.
I don't know where my parents are, or my brothers and sisters.
He was put in a Chinese re-education camp, he says, just for reciting an Islamic verse at a funeral. His family, he fears, is still in one.
They want us to renounce our beliefs, our ethnicity, and our humanity.
In general, how did the guards treat the people inside?
Their treatment was really violent. They didn't treat us like we were humans. The guards spoke to us in an immoral and terrible way.
Some of those we meet are too afraid, even here in Turkey, to speak openly. This man, whom we're calling Ali, says he was also put in a camp because of his religion.
I had a picture of a lady wearing a face veil, so they detained me.
Tell me everything you remember about life in the re-education center.
Every day we were woken early by a loud siren. We had just 5 minutes to make our beds and then assemble in the camp square for inspection. The first day I didn't stand straight for inspection, so they kept me under the hot sun for 8 hours with no breakfast. I completely lost consciousness.
Ablut Tursun Toti is another former inmate from another camp. His account bears striking similarities to the ones we've just heard, as does his concern for the fate of relatives left behind.
I just heard yesterday, they told me there is no one left.
The whole family?
All my brothers and sisters have been detained, and all their children over 18.
Tell me about life there. What was the routine?
They woke us up an hour before sunrise, and we had to be ready in 1 minute. Otherwise, they beat us. Until sunrise, they had us run around the square.
It's a common camp routine, it seems. Here's Abdusalam Mehmet again.
In the early morning, we had to run around the square for a long time. It was torture. People fell down. They badly injured their feet.
It may be slightly difficult for you, Abdusalam, but can you give me some examples of the sort of things that you were forced to say?
They had lots of Chinese poems we had to learn and recite about how without the Chinese we couldn't live. If we couldn't recite them, they wouldn't feed us.
Let me ask you, Ali, about the so-called education that they were providing. What else were they making you do?
We had to sing Communist Party songs and the national anthem, and we had to sing it exactly together, or we'd get no breakfast. They made us work. They taught me nothing but torture.
The re-education, the three men tell us, consists of little more than crude rote learning. As well as the singing of patriotic songs, there was the reciting of Xinjiang's anti-extremism regulations. Ablut Tursun Toti remembers them well.
They told us, you need to learn the rules. We have to change the politically incorrect views in your mind. So they taught us a lot of law. For teaching children religion, you'd get 5 to 7 years in prison. For praying on the streets, 3 to 5 years.
Did you experience anything you would describe as torture, any kind of physical punishment?
Every day someone was beaten. There was a special punishment room. There were two men, one to beat and one to kick. If we fell down, then we would be made to kneel again.
The heavy-handed reporting restrictions in Xinjiang also mean, of course, that the testimony we've heard here is impossible to independently verify. But what's striking are the consistencies, the descriptions of the routines in the camps, the brainwashing techniques, and most tellingly, perhaps, the results. Not loyalty and love for the Chinese Communist Party, but a deep and lasting resentment.
Those we've spoken to in Turkey are the lucky ones. They fled here in 2015. Since then, there have been very few reports of anyone being released from the camps at all. China denies it is incarcerating Muslims en masse. But state-run TV has been showing classrooms full of adults sitting in rows, being taught about the pitfalls of religious extremism, for which, the on-camera interviews suggest, they are all deeply grateful.
Without this, I might have followed religious extremists and become a criminal. The Communist Party found me and saved me just in time.
The message is clear. These are not detention centres, but vocational schools. The students are shown learning bread making, sewing, even dancing. There is no mention, of course, of whether he or anyone else is free to leave. One estimate, based on China's own government documents, suggests the number of Uyghurs detained in Xinjiang could now be over 1 million. In the city of Kashgar, we find many Uyghur homes padlocked shut.
I haven't seen you and your family for a while.
My colleague finds one official notice pinned to a door.
For social stability reasons.
In both Chinese and Uyghur, it says that missing residents are being looked after.
Delete everything about me.
But it's impossible to interview anyone. The constant threatening presence of our government minders makes certain of that.
About me. Okay.
Can we get another job, please?
Do you understand?
I didn't take a picture.
Instead, we're presented with an official tour guide. It's an opportunity, at least, to ask a few direct questions.
We've seen notices on the door saying some people's relatives are being looked after. What does that mean?
Maybe they left town to work. Many work in factories in nearby towns.
It doesn't mean they've been taken away?
No. Taken away? They've all gone to work. We have programs to help people find jobs in northern Xinjiang. One of my own relatives is working there.
Nearby, in Kashgar's main square, a man is watering the plants and trees. The central city mosque is just opening for the day. But the only interest comes from a few Chinese tourists taking pictures. We ask the few locals present what time the prayers begin. One puts his fingers to his lips and shakes his head. Nobody comes anymore, the other whispers.
Well, today, as it happens, is a Friday. And anywhere else in the world, you'd expect a central city mosque to be busy, bustling with worshippers. Not here. Just the sound of a solitary security guard mopping the steps. If China's purpose is the eradication of Islamic practice in Xinjiang, well, it may be on the brink of succeeding.
For those left outside the camps, a veneer of normality remains. In a tea house, a group of musicians are playing a traditional Uyghur song. It's a song of loneliness and separation. When will I see my loved ones again? The singer asks. His audience is made up almost entirely of old men, lost in thought or in quiet conversation. In Kashgar, young men in particular these days appear to be far fewer in number.
Two cars, one with what looks like three people in it, and then a police car behind it.
As we arrive in the town of Dabanchung, we're being followed as usual.
So I think there's three cars in total.
An image from 2015, stored on the global mapping software Google Earth, shows a patch of empty desert to the north of Dabanchung. But move the timeline forward to April of this year, and there, on that same patch of sand, a giant compound has now materialised, surrounded by a high wall and 16 watchtowers.
Two cars coming around the corner, and the police car at the back.
Despite the heavy monitoring, we try to approach the site by car.
Look at this.
Only to discover that it's still being extended on a massive scale.
It's like a city.
Then the police block our way.
So here we are then, just a few metres from the camp, and as predicted, we've been stopped. If this really is all about education, then why the effort to stop us getting close?
It's huge.
It's huge.
We ask a team of satellite analysts from GMV Solutions, a multinational aerospace company, to help us understand what we've found.
The thick walls, internal fences.
Taking the Google Earth image of Dabanchung from April this year, they overlay a much more recent picture taken by a different satellite.
We can see that all this is new.
Yeah.
Everything. Double.
Even more.
It's clear how much the site has grown. The number of buildings has multiplied and spread across the previously bare desert floor. And senior analyst Anna Sebastian is able to show that this one camp is part of something much bigger, with many other similar and rapidly growing facilities being built right across Xinjiang.
The satellites see beyond what the human eye can see. The technology allows you to detect, for example, elements that are clearly elements for security. So as the years pass, we have detected that the number of infrastructures being built increases, and most significantly in the past 2 years.
We gave our satellite images of the site at Dabanchung to a company with expertise in prison design, the Australian-based Goima Bailey Architects. Their analysis suggests it could now be one of the biggest detention facilities in the world, holding up to 11,000 inmates if single rooms were used, to as many as 130,000 if the inmates were housed in dormitories.
There was a vehicle that crashed into a crowd.
Ethnic tension, fueled by resentment towards Chinese rule, has claimed hundreds of lives in Xinjiang.
The location of this incident is really suspicious.
In recent years, the violence has shown signs of spreading.
China vows to track down those responsible for an attack at a railway station.
31 people were slaughtered in a knife attack in the city of Kunming in 2014. And hundreds of Uyghurs are reported to have travelled to Syria to join various militant groups. The camps are a direct response, a giant system in city after city, town after town, targeting almost any expression of Islamic faith and any overseas connection of any kind.
The Chinese government, they want to delete the Uyghur nations from the world. They want to just, you know, erase these nations.
Rahila Abdullayati is a British Uyghur living in London.
Yeah, this is me and my mom.
Last summer, her mother came to visit.
So this is really one of the last times you saw her?
Yes.
But soon after she returned to Xinjiang, she was taken away. 66-year-old Sharmushina Pida is now thought to be in a camp. Proof, her daughter says, of just how wide China's definition of extremism now is.
As far as I know, they're targeting everybody else, whoever's relatives abroad. So, you know, I'm not involved in any political activities. I'm just normal person, studying student, looking after my son. Why they been detained my moms? For what? For no reason.
I don't know when I'm going to hear their voice. I'm just hoping them alive. That's my first hope.
Mahmoud Turdi is another British Uyghur who has watched helplessly as family members back home disappear.
My sister's in prison. She had done nothing wrong. She was a government employee. You are like an egg. The Chinese government's like a stone. They can crush you anytime, and they are so powerful.
Mahmoud and Rahila want the UK and other governments to do more.
But I hope our British government stand up and speak up and put pressure on the Chinese government.
But you feel that the international community may be scared of challenging China too hard?
So probably everybody, they don't want to lose China, like as a business-wise. Money is important, but we are human. We are not animals. Everything is on there, on the table. So just act.
International pressure is beginning to mount. At a UN hearing in November, Western countries one by one expressed deep unease.
We're very concerned about the treatment of ethnic minorities, including Uyghurs and Tibetans.
And all unlawful detention, including unconstitutional mass detention of Uyghurs and other Muslims in Xinjiang.
Release Uyghurs and other Muslims who have been detained arbitrarily.
But China's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs, Liu Yucheng, gave a defiant response.
Xinjiang has built educational facilities in order to combat terrorism and eradicate extremist thoughts in a small group of people. We will not accept politically driven accusations from a few countries which are fraught with bias and are seriously far away from facts. Nor will we allow human rights as an excuse to interfere in China's affairs.
Despite making numerous attempts to contact the Chinese government for a response to our evidence, though, we've received no reply. When Bilkis Habibullah fled Xinjiang with her children, her baby daughter, Sakine, didn't have a passport. Her father stayed behind, planning to bring her later. But now he's been taken away. Stranded in Turkey, Bilkis has no idea what has happened to baby Sakine.
I had no choice but to leave her behind. She didn't have a passport. If she could hear me now, I would say nothing but sorry. I can't love her as a mother should. I don't even know where she is. There is nothing more miserable than not knowing whether she is alive or dead.
Sitting with her in their small Istanbul apartment, Bilkis's five other children are all weeping quietly too. She tells me they once lived a comfortable life in Xinjiang, but now depend on the little money she can earn as a teacher and on charity.
What is your view about what the Chinese government is doing in Xinjiang?
Our hearts cannot bear this pain. I want the whole world to hear our voice. I want them to give all our Uyghur Muslim brothers and sisters our human rights back to us.
In total, the satellite analysts from GMV found 44 suspected re-education centres with clearly visible security features, such as watchtowers and barbed wire. All have been built or expanded at remarkable speed. For example, one site just outside Kashgar has been transformed from an empty field to a highly secure re-education camp in less than 6 months.
Is that the road there?
We attempt to visit it, hoping to film and record outside the complex of 8 large four-story buildings.
Police car in front of it.
We're just able to grab a few pictures of one of the watchtowers before the police once again intervene.
We're not going to be able to go any further.
Re-education, vocational training, to use China's euphemisms, suggests something limited and temporary. But our evidence shows that the camps and prisons being used for that purpose are large-scale and seemingly permanent. The big question, then, is where does all of this end? And the history of mass incarcerations, of course, offers some pretty ominous precedents.
We make one final attempt to visit one final camp.
We just shut down the whole road.
In front of us, though, the police close the whole highway. For repair, they say.
Is there another way?
So I think we want to go straight on.
We try other routes, but every time...
Are they going to turn us back here?
At roadblock?
No.
After roadblock...
We're not going to get anywhere close to it.
There is no way through.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program or have any comments or suggestions, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you and seeing you again very soon. Until next time, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, thanks so long, and take care.